Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name's Patrick Gray, and this is the last episode of the weekly edition of the show for 2018. And on this edition, we're going to look back at all of the week's security news, the considerable amount of security news with Adam Boileau, before jumping right on into this week's sponsor interview with Casey Ellis of BugCrowd. But yes, Adam, as I mentioned, it's been a big week for news. And funnily enough, you know, last week we spent a bit of time talking about Huawei stuff. And then there were some major developments.
Yeah, the story has rather escalated. The headline most people will have seen is that the chief financial officer of Huawei was arrested in Canada, allegedly in relation to a Huawei subsidiary involved in busting sanctions into Iran. And then that's obviously turned into rather the sort of a dispute between China and, well, Canada and the US. And, you know, Trump's kind of weighed in with his assertion that this is somehow related to a trade deal with China, which really isn't helping anyone.
He's like, hey, maybe we can work something out, you know?
Yeah,
Mr. Ren Zhengfei, I've got your daughter. Because that's something that's worth mentioning is that, you know, the CFO of Huawei is the founder, the founder's daughter, Ren Zhengfei's daughter. I mean, woof.
That really, yeah, adds a very personal element to it. And I imagine he is far from impressed. And of course, you know, being ex-PLA, as we've discussed many times, he will have quite some opinions, I'm sure, that he's sharing with people.
Well, ex-PLA or not, the guy is, you know, is very influential and has a lot of connections in cloud, right? So this is some high-stakes stuff.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I guess we're not quite sure where this is going to head. Ming Wangzhu has applied for bail in Canada, which I gather she's now got. You know, if she flees the country, that's going to add an interesting wrinkle to it. If she doesn't flee the country and gets extradited to the US, that's going to add an interesting wrinkle to it. If she does get extradited, then, you know, who knows what's going to happen. Yeah, complicated and interesting International Relations Day.
Meanwhile, this former Canadian diplomat, Michael Kovrig, has been detained in China. I'm not exactly clear on what the charges are, but some people are inferring that this might be like a tit-for-tat response by China. I mean, I haven't seen anything to suggest that that's the case, but it's certainly what people are saying could be happening.
Yeah, there's certainly no obvious connection between the two, but I mean, people are drawing that parallel regardless, and it adds a wrinkle to what's already a pretty tense kind of conversation.
Yeah, yeah. Now, meanwhile, BT in the UK is apparently ripping out Huawei equipment from parts of its 4G network already. I mean, we've seen Huawei excluded from various builds all around the world, but I mean, this is a bit of an escalation when you got people actually, you know, pulling their equipment out of racks and throwing it on the scrap heap.
Well, exactly right. We talked in the context of the New Zealand discussion, you know, last week, whenever it was, you know, that it's much easier to have these concerns up front before the network's built, and ripping it out is a much more complicated step. So this does seem like a bit of a turnaround, especially given that the UK has been, you know, more accepting of Huawei equipment in their telco cores because of the relationship of that kind of inner auditing process they've been going through. So yeah, if BT really are starting to rip out Huawei from the middle of their 3G and 4G networks, then yeah, that's definitely, you know, a kind of a change in posture in the UK.
Rob Joyce of the NSA, you know, made some interesting comments at an event recently, just basically saying that, you know, Chinese cyber espionage against the United States was ramping up, and trust us, we have specific intelligence on Huawei, but no, we are not going to share it.
Which is kind of sad, because obviously we would like to see that very much. You know, everyone is, you know, has to operate, I guess, on the assumption that they're, you know, that they're serious. I mean, they must be, right, for the reactions we've been seeing. But yeah, it's always a challenge when you're out here in the, you know, in the private world, you know, to know that there are, quote, what, real grounded examples, unquote, and that they're not going to tell us. But, you know, there must be real grounded examples then.
Now, look, another big thing that happened this week is the United States released the results of its investigation into the Equifax breach. The U.S. government has now described that breach as entirely preventable. The report makes for, I'm told, extremely sobering reading. And, yeah, like everybody's been flipping through it over the last couple of days.
Yeah, the report is pretty savage. You know, they call it entirely preventable. They say that it's kind of come about because they didn't really have strong reporting and strong leadership in the IT and IT security areas, and that as overall as a business, they really hadn't taken into account, you know, how valuable their data was, how important it was to the customers, and, you know, how incumbent it was upon them to do a good job of protecting it. And it specifically calls out a bunch of acquisitions and places where they've merged other companies in without really thinking how that changed the value of the data and the way that the systems worked. So yeah, pretty savage. It also called out their response as being particularly inadequate, or, you know, the fact they weren't prepared for the volume of calls from customers. But yeah, it just doesn't look good for Equifax. And then Equifax's response to this report has also kind of been equally bad in a way. Like, they've kind of argued small points without, you know, kind of accepting, you know, on the chin the real bulk of the report, which, regardless of whether there's some inaccuracies in terms of timelines and things.
Well, Adam, you know, when someone kicks you in the nuts, you don't have to say thank you, you know? Like,
No, but I mean, you know, in the end, it's all of the people's data that they lost, you know, they owe them that to come out and be responsible for it. So.
Well, a funny one here from Joe Cox at Motherboard, which is Experian, apparently was using real customer data in its training manuals. Oops.
Yeah, that one's pretty funny. I mean, it's like one business and their credit rating and a bunch of other like internal ratings generated by Experian were used in some screenshots. So not the world's, you know, most egregious privacy breach, but still just boneheaded.
Now, look, this one's been doing the rounds on Twitter, but you know, I'm kind of curious as to why it's doing that now, because this post is dated October 23. But look, it is definitely worth talking about. There's a huge dispute between a company that got hosed by NotPetya and its insurance provider, Adam. What can you tell us about this?
This is Mondelez, the kind of global giant food and beverage company who got hosed by NotPetya, as you said, and they lost something like $100 million worth of, you know, they experienced $100 million worth of losses as a result of, you know, interruption to their business from having to deal with their unpatched Windows boxes getting owned by NSA exploits by Russia. They had an insurance policy with Zurich International, the you know, big insurer. They went and claimed under their insurance, which appeared to cover them for exactly this kind of thing. And it turns out not so much. The insurance company turned around and said, actually, terribly sorry, that was an act of war. You're not covered. Tough. They, of course, have gone ahead and sued the Zurich American Insurance Company for the amount, for the $100 million or so. And yeah, they're going to have to argue about it in court. Presumably they're going to settle, because, I mean, the insurer's job here is going to be to prove that it was a Russian state act of, you know, kind of act of war, which, you know, might be a little challenging for them. But yeah, interesting.
Yeah, let's hope they don't settle so we all can get the popcorn, right?
Yeah, exactly. I guess the point of the story is, if you do have insurance for this kind of thing, and it will almost certainly have exclusions for war-like things, maybe consider whether that insurance is, you know, appropriate, whether the same clauses were appropriate in the physical world are still appropriate in the cyber world, where you might be more likely to suffer an act of war.
That's an interesting and sobering thought for our last show of 2018. Katalin Kimpanu for ZDNet has written that a bunch of malware crews have amassed like 40,000 credentials for government portals from various countries. They've amassed, like a lot of creds for a lot of governments.
Yeah, apparently this is from a botnet operator that got owned, and then the Russian firm that owned them figured out, went through the user list, and there's a whole bunch of different users from a bunch of different government portals and websites and, you know, internal government things. So these are user accounts of people who work at those governments as opposed to, you know, citizens, I think. But yeah, reasonable stash of them. Sounds like it's just regular Common Garden kind of malware collecting them, presumably part of a larger trove rather than anything targeted.
Australia's assistance and access bill in, you know, what I can only, I mean, look, the whole thing turned into a farce last week after we recorded the show. That bill has now passed with promises by the opposition party to try to amend it later. And now we've got the government today saying that, you know, damn the Australian Labor Party, they're trying to water down this serious anti-terrorist measure and blah, blah, blah. It's all gone ridiculous. We've seen some balanced coverage come out. We've seen people saying they're going to ban maths. The whole thing is just a giant mess, Adam.
Yeah, it really has. I mean, Twitter was pretty unbearable, you know, for the kind of 24 hours after that got passed. There was so much kind of badly informed cypherpunk, you know, wailing and gnashing of teeth, and, you know, a few pieces of good commentary here and there, unusually for Twitter. But yeah, just such a mess. And then, of course, it's really not helped by the, you know, Australian politics being just sort of, you know, unending bickering and turmoil about politics rather than about the issues, which, you know, makes it all worse. But yeah, it's just been a complete mess. And it's good to see that there has been some coverage that explains in a bit more balanced terms what it means, but the actual what it means long term, we still don't really know. And that's, you know, I think what does have people worried.
People ask me, oh, you know, do you support this bill? And I'm like, frankly, I don't, because I think it is a little bit vague. Do I think it's as bad as people are saying? No, because I don't think people are, you know, authorities are actually going to try to use it in some of the ways that people fear that they will. It doesn't mean I support the bill. I'm just saying perhaps the sky isn't falling. But look, one thing I did want to do this week is actually to talk about some of the context in which this is happening in Australia. You know, last month we had a guy go berserk in Bourke Street in Melbourne and stab a few people and try to blow up his car and whatnot. I mean, the guy was clearly bonkers. He was shot and killed by police. Shortly thereafter, three men were arrested in Melbourne, and their plan was to try to acquire a semi-automatic weapon so that they could go on a shooting spree and kill a lot of people. Now, police did have interceptions running on all of these people, but they could not, according to the news reports, they could not actually get some of their communications because they were heavily using encryption.
And I mean, you would certainly expect these days that people planning this kind of thing, you know, are going to use encrypted messaging apps. You know, we've seen the advice, you know, for all sorts of people, you know, from, you know, jihadis and terrorist groups through to, you know, regular people advocating the use of end-to-end crypto. And people do kind of understand that's an option that they have and that they should probably consider. And, you know, clearly they are.
But don't you feel like maybe this side of the debate is something that tech ignores a little bit? Do you know what I mean? Like they sort of downplay the risks involved in just sort of giving everyone completely impenetrable comms.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's very much a dual use technology, like so many things that we have in the tech industry, you know, where you can use them, you know, for whatever you want. And there are plenty of people who want to do bad things. And that's that's always been the double edge of these things. And yeah, I mean, we're very prone as technologists to, you know, look for the thing that we want to use it for and not necessarily consider what else. I mean, or even just when you look at the engineering, the challenge, the technology as its own reward for you as the engineer building it without ever considering it. I mean, that kind of, Von Braun Faustian bargain where, you know, you're happy to make rockets because you want to go to space and you don't care that they're made by slave labor to kill people. And yeah, I mean, I think there is a degree of that throughout the tech and the engineering industries.
I mean, I think where I've arrived is that, you know, I totally accept arguments that say any sort of interception regime or any sort of bowing to authorities under these types of orders does represent a risk to everybody's privacy and security. But also, you know, I actually asked a terrorism expert this question today. I just said, real quick, you're the terrorism expert here. Do you think concerns around jihadis using encryption tech are overhyped? I just want your take on that. Now, Andrew Zammit is the person I asked. He is from the Global Terrorism Research Center at Monash University, and his reply was, the quick answer is no, I don't think it's overhyped. The official figure is that 95% of ASIO's most dangerous CT targets use encrypted messaging, and I don't know of any reason to doubt that. I'm not an expert on the tech side, but it seems intuitive that people trying to avoid state attention would use encrypted tech and would keep doing so. And when some IS plots have been brought to court, there's often evidence that IS figures in Syria and Iraq advised their Western-based plotters to use various types of encryption. So, you know, I think we do need to say, okay, look, sure, introducing technical capability notices, could they introduce risks to our comms? Yes, I think we have to accept that. Yes, I think that is fact. But we need to balance that against this other stuff, which I think is probably a little more serious than people realize. Like the counterterrorism officials are freaking out over this stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, in the end, you know, the absolute right to privacy, you know, is a thing the state can suspend for its citizens, you know, in the interest of everybody, you know, of the
you
men. Know, right?
You just gave a whole bunch of Americans aneurysms when you said that.
I know, right? But because what's the alternative? Are we going to get into a position where, you know, Apple turns around or Google turns around to the Australian government and says, no, you know, we're not going to help you enforce your own laws in your own land? Tough.
Well, we hit that point a couple of years back, man, to be honest.
Well, yeah, but I mean, then what? I mean, Apple gets banned from Australia or what, right? I mean,
well, then we get this law is what happens. That's how we got here.
Well, exactly. We end up with a law like this and then what, right? We don't, we decide it's not going to work. Apple says no. They get thrown out of the country. We end up with, you know, balkanized per country messaging systems, per country hardware, you know, no more internet connectivity. I mean, it's just, you know, that kind of a, you know, that's really not a place that we want to end up going. We have to find some middle ground that works, you know?
Yeah. Indeed. Turning our attention to one of our favorite topics, which is Bloomberg's 2018 dumpster fire. Supermicro engaged a third party to do a real comprehensive audit. My guess is they did this in this is groundwork for a lawsuit. That's my feeling. But they engaged a third party to look into Bloomberg's claims, and they say they've come up with nothing. Bloomberg, now this is interesting. Bloomberg is even reporting on this. And there's a line in there that I just thought is fascinating, which is Bloomberg Businessweek has previously said that it stands by its story. Now, that's interesting. When you got Bloomberg itself saying Bloomberg Businessweek has previously said that it stands by its story, you know, I mean, that is Bloomberg right now saying we are not saying that we stand by the story anymore. That's a shift in position.
It is, right? And that line stuck out to me as well, because that's not the same as Bloomberg Businessweek stands by its story. Right? That is a very different sentence. And it's not the, like, you wouldn't write that sentence without thinking that through.
I mean, can you imagine if your missus asks you, do you love me? And you say, I have previously stated that I love you?
yeah, that's going to go well for you, right? You're going to get a slap around the chops. So, yeah.
So let's keep an eye on that one. But I really do feel that we'll probably get a correction. How's that for hedging? I really do feel that we'll probably get a correction next year, but let's see. I think the odds are good that one's going to get pulled. The journalists, meanwhile, you know, still no one's heard from them. I don't know if they got renditioned or something, but no one's heard a peep out of them since that story ran. Oh, someone defaced Linux.org with Goatsy and an anti-diversity tirade. They sound like wonderful people.
Oh, geez, yeah. Like, seriously, can you? I mean, it's, you know. I, for one, you know, I enjoy a good defacement here and there, but for God's sake, can we come up with something better than that? Like, that's just rubbish.
I mean, Goatsy is a defacement. I mean, that's one of the internet's, you know, golden oldies. It's one of the greatest hits.
It's a classic, right? It's a vintage meme, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, just rubbish.
Now, a couple of weeks back, we spoke with Alex Stamos about, you know, this weird process by which, you know, through which the UK Parliament wound up with a whole bunch of Facebook internal documents. They're on the internet now. Woo!
Yeah, the British Parliament has dumped the docs for everyone to read, which, yes, people have been mining through it, finding all sorts of choice examples of Facebook kind of being jerks and writing them up. And, yeah, it really doesn't look good for Facebook, this particular stash of docs. I mean, Facebook have been saying, oh, well, it's taken out of context and blah, 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 blah.
There's so many of these, like, internal memos where they're like, yeah, gee, if people found out about this, they'd sure freak out. Oh, well, it's worth the PR risk, you know, stuff like that. I mean, it just sort of shows that they knew what they were doing, right?
Yeah, exactly. One particularly funny bit is where the VP of product management is talking about how one of the kind of features they've been trying to sell to advertise and things has primarily only been taken up by gaming companies. And he says, quote, I'm not proud of the fact that we're currently extolling game companies that make slot machines as a positive example of those willing to pay our fees. Open bracket. I'm fine with it, just not proud of it. Close bracket.
Yeah, damn. That's the thing.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
Google, meanwhile, having some more drama with Google Plus, which is just hilarious. Apparently, they exposed data from 52.5 million users, to which I saw people on Twitter saying, wow, Google Plus had 50 million users. But yeah, they exposed a bunch of data on 52.5 million users. They'd already planned to pull the plug on Google Plus, but apparently those plans have been accelerated. They're like trying to sprint it into the paddock to put a bullet in its head.
Yeah, this is apparently another instance of the same sort of thing they had last time, where there was some particular API that didn't correctly enforce the restrictions on, you know, seeing information about about other people that were related to their users in question. They appear to have identified this through internal auditing. And I guess, you know, in that respect, they didn't have to tell everybody that they had a bug. They are saying that there's no evidence that was actually used. But yeah, the fact that it exposed that many user accounts, I guess, is the thing they felt they had to go out in front. And yeah, I mean, I guess the fact that it's going to get a bullet soon is probably going to make everybody happy.
Now, earlier this year, the city of Atlanta suffered a pretty serious ransomware attack. Some Iranians have been indicted over this. It doesn't look like there was any sort of state level involvement, but they found some people apparently.
Yeah, there's no specifics about how these two individuals were actually kind of doxed and identified by the investigation. You know, they were using a set of malware, the SamSam malware, that there were a bunch of people using at the time. There isn't, it isn't really clear whether these two people were also responsible for some of the other ones. Yeah, so we're not really sure about that. Yeah, we're not really clear also whether or not they will ever actually face those charges. I assume they're still in Iran and are not likely to get extradited, but maybe don't go on holiday to Mexico, eh?
Yeah, that's right. Huh, what? Get in the van. And WeChat guy got vanned last week. We were like, that guy's totally going to get caught. There's a guy in China who was using WeChat, like WePay over WeChat, to collect his ransomware ransoms. And, you know, you and I suggested last week that he might be arrested, and he was arrested. He got in the van, and the van has taken him to an undisclosed location. So that's a nice follow-up for everyone. The FBI, meanwhile, is investigating comments on the FCC website around net neutrality. Tell us about this one.
So, those of you who are Americans will probably remember the kind of net neutrality debate and drama that happened earlier on in the year. There was a bunch of lobbying around the FCC's comment system for that. It kind of crashed during, you know, the load of people submitting comments initially, and then, you know, there's lots of fake comments being submitted by various groups for and against. There's been a bunch of investigations into that process to see whether people's, you know, have been people whose identities have been used to submit comments, you know, fraudulently. You know, they were going after the people, you know, the campaigns that were doing that for those frauds. The state level investigations have been largely kind of obstructed in terms of getting data out of the FCC. They said, you know, we're a federal organization, go jam it. The FBI is now investigating, which may change that calculus about whether or not they can get data out of the FCC. Specifically things like the web logs, you know, stuff you'd think might be useful to share with an investigation. We don't know where it's going to head yet, but the fact the FBI is on the case now may make the FCC a little uncomfortable.
TechCrunch has a write-up on what looks to be a pretty interesting Microsoft bug.
Yeah, this one's pretty funny. This Indian researcher, he was rummaging in the DNS. He noticed that there was a dangling CNAME DNS record for success.office.com pointing to an Azure, one of the Azure websites.net or whatever it is that you end up getting DNS records for when you run stuff up inside Microsoft Azure. Anyway, that particular name of an Azure, you know, container or app or front end or whatever wasn't currently in use, but still had the CNAME record for success.office.com. So he went and set up the relevant Azure site to capture that name, and at that point he was able to generate links that would send you to the Microsoft Office single sign-on, and then once you'd logged in would send you onwards to his success.office.com with the auth tokens that you had just successfully acquired through login, and at that point he could use any of your office.com or, you know, other Microsoft properties, which is pretty sweet, to be
nice,
honest.
Nice work.
That's great. So that particular CNAME record is now gone. I went and dug it up from, you know, the sort of historical domain services that one might use for such things. It did. That's what it looked like to me on the basis of that particular set of data.
That's nice. That's a nice mass ownage bug too. So Sahad, I tip my hat to you, my friend. I hope you are having a good time there in India. Moving on, and Microsoft has apparently patched another O-Day that's out there in the wild. This is the fourth time in 4 months.
Yeah, this was another Windows kernel local Prevesk bug. Obviously that's being used in the wild for people who presumably pop the boxes via some other means, want to escalate privilege. The fact that we're still seeing these, I guess, you know, is an indication of quite how complicated the Windows environment still is and how many bugs there are to shake out. But yeah, I mean, it's nice in a way, though, that, you know, local Prevesk like this are critical bugs these days on Windows, whereas, you know, 10 years ago, he wouldn't have cared too much about yet another Windows local. So, you know.
I remember when Prevesk, care factor nil.
Yeah, boring, right? So. Yeah, show us remote or GTFO, but yeah. That's real it. Bugs now.
This is another one from ZDNet where apparently people out there scanning for Ethereum mining rigs, like those scans are going through the roof. And the theory is here that people are trying to own as much Ethereum as they can, as quickly as they can before it all becomes completely worthless because, you know, crypto, everything is crashing.
Which, you know, I agree with the sentiment. I think more likely it's just one person decided to go scan for it, and that's all it takes to make that much scanning noise these days. You know,
yeah, I kind of think the theory might be a bit bunk, but it's a cool story.
But it's the feeling that counts, you know.
It is.
anything lets us laugh at crypto nerds that sort of crypto is good done. Good fun.
Now, we all love a good OPSEC mistake, and we got one here.
Yeah. Dear, this guy who was selling counterfeit euro banknotes on various dark websites, he got run and busted by the police. It turns out that even though he was doing all of his criminal enterprises via, you know, the Tor Onion dark webs using cryptocurrency for secure transport of money, yeah, he had some files with all of the postal addresses of where he'd been sending his orders.
His customer database. Did they manage to break into his HubSpot account or something and, you know, find his yeah. sales pipeline projections? It's hilarious, Salesforce. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's pretty funny. But yeah, it's a bad OPSEC on his behalf, and now they've rounded up everyone who bought counterfeit currency from this guy. So yes,
300 house searches and 235 arrests, and I'm guessing they're the 235 houses where there was still some of this funny money, and the other ones, the other people who spent it quickly, were a little bit luckier. Mm-hmm. Oh, Marriott hotels are going to reimburse some of the guests who had their data exposed in their mega breach. They're going to—it's just so weird. 2018 is weird. They're going to compensate them so they can get new passports because Marriott lost their passport numbers. Who is getting reimbursed for this and why? Like, why are some guests' passport numbers more important than others, Adam? Like, walk me through this.
Well, apparently what Marriott would like you to do to claim the, you know, $100 or whatever it costs in your local jurisdiction to get a new passport, what they would like you to do is to prove that you have been a victim of fraudulent operations in which your passport number was involved. Otherwise, tough, you don't get $100, which seems like a pretty high bar for the average Marriott.
Might be setting
Marriott's
the bar just a little high, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you have to show up with concrete attribution about how your passport number was used by somebody else that you don't know about.
Please fill out our form in triplicate and attach a 3,000-word essay on dialectical materialism and, get it to us within 12 hours and we'll consider processing your request by the year 2023.
I mean, you'd think even, validating whether or not someone – I mean, obviously they're not expecting anyone. I mean, that's the point, right? They're not expecting anyone to go through this process, not going to have to pay any money. That's great. Everyone wins except everyone who lost everything. But, yeah, you would think that the process of validating these, stories about how your passport was used fraudulently would cost more in employee time than just paying out the damn money to everybody whose passports you lost. So maybe think about doing that.
They can't afford to give everyone $100, man, because that's like, the GDP of Germany or something. But anyway, Marriott just being weasels there. Look, this one's really cool. Apparently some hackers in Europe are using Dropboxes to own banks in pretty spectacular ways, like tens of millions of dollars stolen apparently. They're getting physical access to the banks, plugging stuff into the network and then getting out there. And hey, they're in a good position to start attacking the LAN at that point.
Yeah, well, it's a great example of, as a hacker, you attack where the defenses are weak, right? And if you make the perimeter too strong, right, if you patch your struts, you have phishing training for your employees and you don't let everyone use admin everywhere, then they're just going to walk in, plug in a Raspberry Pi with a cell modem and, Kerberos domain admin and carry on and own your bank, right? I mean, whatever works is good for the attackers. And, I think that people need to remember, that when you improve things in one place, you just kind of move the attackers around. Rather than necessarily make them go away.
Now, we got a story here also on a Chrome extension named Postman, which apparently has been doing some shifty stuff with people's browsing data.
Yeah, there's a clone of the regular the tool Postman has been used by web developers for manipulating post requests and things. It's a pretty widely used tool by web developers. There is a clone one on the Chrome App Store, I imagine, or Chrome Extension Store. I imagine it'll be gone pretty quickly after this because hi Google, we know that you you'll hang about and listen. It'll be gone very quickly. Apparently, it was backdoored, logging people's browser details. And browsing history details. Not quite sure what else it was doing after that. But Chrome extensions have just been a sore point for all sorts of people.
I'm waiting for a big one. I'm waiting for something serious to happen with that next year. I reckon maybe something bad will happen before Google can really get on top of this. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think, there are a bunch of really high-profile extensions that lots of people use. I mean, I'm thinking probably the big ad blockers would be the ones that strike me as most likely, either a bug in one of those or, proper supply chain takeover. If one of the big ad blockers got taken out then and used for, serious business, jack everyone's creds kind of thing, that would go pretty badly, I reckon.
Finally, before we go, Adam, there's a feature here that's been doing the rounds, a New York Times feature all about the way that apps track your location. And it's one of those, it's one of those really well put together stories that makes people go, whoa, okay, I didn't quite realize that, right? And people have been suitably freaked out by it, which is encouraging.
Yeah, it's a great story. And also the sort of story that, you know, you could share with your family and share with your friends that are, you know, perhaps not quite so technical, but that is really relatable for them. So, yeah, it's a great story to pass around. It goes through, you know, the kind of the way that mobile phone applications do location tracking of people, and then kind of follows the thread of where does that data go? What does it get used for? What's the business model behind it? Which I think is a really important part of the story, right? To explain, you know, that whole thing. So that when people see a pop-up, you know, from the mobile app that they've installed saying, hey, we'd like your location data to show you, you know, travel times or nearby gas stations, that's not the only thing that it might be doing with it, that it could ship it off, you know. And in some cases, there's location tracking apps that are, you know, shipping data with, you know, minute-level resolution, selling it onwards to data aggregators who are then, you know, building profiles of people and customers and selling that to advertisers. And I mean, the New York Times piece actually does go through and end up talking to some of the companies that acquire this data and, you know, what they use it for. And there's a great quote from one of these organizations basically saying, well, hey, you got the app for free. This is how you're paying for it. You know, deal with it. Welcome to the future. Which, you know, for a lot of people, and obviously the people that the New York Times use in their story to explain it and kind of make it human, you know, that's not the bargain that they thought they signed up for. So, yeah, it's a great story. Very well-written piece and, you know, very relatable for, you know, people beyond our immediate, you know, technical field.
Yeah. Well, Adam, that's actually it for the news for this week, which means that's it for the news for 2018. And, you know, I always get to the end. I've got to the end of the last few years and I've thought to myself, gee, you know, this has been the biggest year ever. But, you know, when I look back on it, 2016, 2017, we're not exactly, you know, we weren't exactly skipping through meadows having a great old time. Like it's, you know, the internet's been a pretty wild place the last few years.
Yeah, I mean, the internet and all of the, you know, computer security issues and then the wider, you know, geopolitics has just become more and more of what we talk about on the show because everything is kind of, you know, tied together and used for a purpose, right? It's not just a bunch of nerds having fun on the tubes anymore. And yeah, every year seems to get, as you say, bigger and bigger. And, you know, once you go on holiday, I'm sure it'll get even worse, even though we've only got, you know, a couple of weeks left this year.
Yeah. Well, look, thanks for everything over the year, Adam. It's been, you know, as always, it's been just so much fun doing this with you week in, week out. And I'll chat to you again in 2019, my friend.
Yeah, it has. It's been a lot of fun. And I will also look forward to next year and all of the terrible things that happen between now and then to talk about. So, yes, happy holidays.
That was Adam Boileau there. Big thanks to Adam, again, for all of his fantastic contributions through this year. Before we get on to this week's sponsor interview, a quick announcement. AppSec California is taking place between January 22 and January 25 in 2019 in Santa Monica. Of course, in Southern California, it will kick off with 2 days of hands-on training by world-class expert trainers such as Jim Manico and Peter Kim. Days 3 and 4 will have 4 concurrent sessions on a variety of security topics that can make you better at solving challenges in AppSec. The conference is attended by software developers, attackers and defenders, ranging from individual contributors to executives. Tickets and sponsorships are on sale now at appseccalifornia.org. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Casey Ellis of BugCrowd, the outsourced bug bounty company. Well, that's what you would have called them in the past, but it may not be what you'll call them in the future. As you're about to hear, BugCrowd has launched something it's calling Next Generation Pen Tests. Now, they announced this some time back, and a bunch of pen testers that I know, like, they went absolutely wild over BugCrowd's marketing around this concept. I got DMs, let me tell you. Oh, I got DMs. But as you'll hear, BugCrowd branching out into a pay-for-effort model alongside their pay-for-results model, it actually makes a lot of sense. I mean, look at the Facebook bug that resulted in tens of millions of access tokens being stolen a couple months back. And, you know, that was a couple of bugs in their core apps. Now, in some bounty programs, hunters may shy away from looking at core apps because, you know, they're just worried they're not going to be able to find anything because those apps have a lot of attention. So they move on and they try to find more peripheral stuff that's a bit easier. Now, Casey has a couple of things to say about that. First of all, that by adjusting incentives for core app bugs, you can get more hours thrown at them. But secondly, paying people more or less by the hour through the BugCrowd platform to apply certain methodologies to certain apps is something that you can now do through them. You know, and this is so, the thinking goes, that under this model, you'll know what's been tested, not just what the crowd has found. So to kick off the conversation, I asked Casey if some bug hunters do have a tendency to ignore core apps that are perceived perceived as being heavily reviewed prior to deployment versus trying to find issues in secondary systems and apps. And here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I think that can be a thing just because there's so much low-hanging fruit still out there. So if you think about it from the hacker's side, if they're putting a number of hours in and expecting to get an amount of cash out, and they've got the option to go deep and try to, you know, go after vulnerabilities that are going to be more difficult to find and kind of close an exploit on versus go to the fringe and find things that have been forgotten about or whatever else, you know, there's kind of a natural cost benefit, you know, calculation that they're doing that comes into that. But, you know, there are some tweaks that can happen to basically mitigate that. I mean, the first and the most obvious one is to make sure that the rewards that are encouraging, you know, depth testing, like high impact, high criticality testing are higher. And there's that lever that can be pulled. We've seen customers going out and basically publishing what their Armageddon scenario looks like. And, you know, saying, hey, this is like the kind of threats that, you know, as a scenario that would affect our business are most impactful. If you can recreate anything that looks like that, you get a higher reward and different things like that. And then, you know, on top of that, what we're starting to introduce is this concept of grants, where there's this component of pay for effort that's basically run alongside the existing concept of pay for results.
Now, this is really interesting, because this is a departure from the core offering of companies like, you know, BugCrowd and your competitors, which is now you're saying, well, you can engage consulting time through us. Essentially, that's what you're doing.
In a nutshell, yeah. I mean, I think that's, you know, going all the way back to it becoming a consulting platform is definitely not on the to-do list at all. But the whole idea of, you know, how do you get people to do work and to apply a methodology to their testing and then produce the output of that methodology in a way that informs the rest of the submissions that come in through the program? You know, how do you achieve that? And that's really what we've built out. You know, one of the things, again, it's a good aspect of the pay for results model, but it can be a downside as well. You know, people only get paid if they complete the loop and actually find an exploitable thing. So, you know, what happens if you're digging through stuff and you start to find things that smell funny, or, you know, you don't have necessarily an incentive to go down this particular path to lead to a critical vulnerability that's there because your specialization is in a different area? Those kind of questions are the things that we're trying to answer with the economics and basically playing around with that.
So how are you packaging this up? I mean, this is, you know, essentially what you're doing is you're paying for effort instead of paying for results, you know, or as well as paying for results in this new, in this new model. Like, what does that look like if I'm on the buying side? Do I get a choice of like vetted approved consultants on the platform? Who picks the hourly rate? How does this work?
Yeah, so one of the things that we basically released, you know, listeners of the show and people that have talked to me about what we do here have probably heard me talk before about this as something that I see as providing a huge benefit to ROI in traditional consulting and pen test spend, right? We released a product about a month and a half ago now called Next Gen Pen Test, which is essentially the packaging of what I just talked about.
There's a lot of pissed off pen testers out there, man. Well, as yeah, you know, can, right? Like they don't like the marketing at all.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting one, because I think part of the problem there is that no one knows what the hell pen test means anymore. I think when you think about it from the spectrum of like public unauthenticated web app testing right through to, you know, let's falsify a North Korean passport and break into a data center, it's all called pen test. And part of what we frankly had to struggle with internally is like, to what degree do we basically try to explain the now many different things that roll up into that term? And that's, I think, part of the consternation that we got back from some of the folks in the pen test industry. But the reality of it is, if you sit down and talk to all of them, they're all annoyed to some degree about the people that are out there just making a bunch of money off doing a pretty terrible job. And, you know, the folks that especially focus on boutique, or, you know, the kind of the hardcore work where there's a lot of trust involved, or they need to, you know, stay behind for 12 months to help people remediate and set up like SDLCs and, you know, remediation strategies and all this other stuff. Those are the things that aren't as suited to the crowd that we actually see ourselves complementing over time. So that, like, there's this idea of, you know, bug finding, like attack simulation at scale, that's something that the crowd's perfect for. But these other parts of security assessment that are also generically referred to as pen tests, those are the things that we're actually going to slot into.
Okay, but like, I'll just go back to the question, right? Which is me on the buying side, how do I set this up? Like, do I have a choice of resources? Are they advertising their methodologies? Do they have an hourly rate, or do I post the spec and the methodology I want and an amount, and then, you know, someone comes forward to claim that amount? How does this work?
Yeah, in essence, the buying side, they procured in the same way that they would a normal pen test. So they basically go out and say, here's the targets, here's the window, here's the reasons for doing this pen test in the first place, which is what informs the methodologies that are put in front of the participants. So if it's, you know, PCI, if it's HIPAA, if it's whatever, we basically, you know, kind of shape things out with what's presented to the folks that are doing the methodology based on that input. And then, you know, off the back of it, the engagement runs, they get reporting off the back of that, they do retesting and all of those different things. It's designed to look functionally identical to what they'd expect to get from the market today. And I think, you know, the only key difference there is, you know, the ability to deliver it on a continuous basis. So you know, we've talked about on demand on the show before, like the idea of basically, you know, push a button, get hackers, do a thing. The thing that we were really thinking about a lot as we put together NGPT is this idea of, you know, how would you deliver a pen test that would satisfy the market's existing expectations of what a pen test is, but then actually do that on a 24/7, you know, 365 days a year basis as well.
Okay. And in terms of picking or selecting resources, how does that work? I mean, is that determined by bug crowd, or is it the first person to snag that, you know, that gig? Like, how does that work? How do you actually vet the quality of the people who are doing the work?
Yeah, got it. So in terms of what we've got, you know, we do the selection, and what we'll do is we'll reflect the selection back to the customer. So they've got some degree of right of refusal to that. But the way that we're doing that is based on all of the information that we've got on the people within the crowd, you know, based on what they've done before. Like, where are their skill sets? Is this someone who has a specific technology bias? What kind of bugs do they like to find and submit? You know, how do we take that information and basically assemble a team that can give really good coverage over this project? How much do we trust them? Like, is this someone who's just walked in and we don't know them from Adam? Or is it someone who has a long history in pen test and, you know, they've passed background checks and all of those other things, and there's a higher degree of confidence in their professionalism as they do the work? So all of that different stuff, we draw from that data, put together a team, and off it goes from there.
And, you know, as you mentioned, this was launched some weeks ago. What's the response been like from the market?
Really solid, really solid. I think, you know, the big thing, it's been interesting actually, because the response from the people that we're already doing work with has basically been, what took you so long? The idea of, you know, they've seen the value and call it, you know, the efficacy of the model, and they've wanted to be able to justify using that model for some of the other business drivers that they have for doing testing, you know, especially when it comes to reporting and compliance and a lot of other stuff. So that's been their reaction. I think from the net new market for us, yeah, it's been a ton of interest around, especially this idea of continuous testing. It's like, I can do a pen test that goes all year round, and it's not the same as hiring someone every day for the year to test all day. Like, just the fact that that's even possible at this point has been really intriguing to them. So yeah, we've done a bunch of them as, you know, new programs that'll launch in 2019 already, and There's a decent queue forming, which is great.
And a lot of this, I suppose, is going to depend on the quality of the people that you can get and assemble, the types of teams you can assemble to deliver the work, which means, right, I guess a lot of your effort right now is going into recruiting.
Well, I mean, to a degree, like, when you think about it, we've got 100,000 signups on the platform right now. There's a, you know, a decent subset of that overall number that's actually active at any given point in time, and we already know a lot about them. You know, we've got folks in the what we call the elite tier, who we have a very high degree of trust in. There's a relationship between them and the team that are helping out customers on delivery of the projects and all of those sorts of things. So we're not, you know, starting from a cold start, if that makes sense, when it goes out to recruiting for ourselves. I think where it's interesting is where we see customers start to lean in on this whole thing and, you know, start to ask questions around you know, their open positions. So it's like, okay, you found people that can come in and do really good work in our place, you know, could we possibly hire them? That would be really great if you could make an introduction.
And so so you're just doing that as an introduction at this stage, but I mean, will there be a time where I can book a resource for, like, I need this person for 7 days, bum on chair in my office? Can I book them through the BugCrowd platform one day, do you think?
I can see a day where we end up doing that type of thing. I do very firmly believe that part of the power of this model comes through the competitive element and the fact that it's, you know, a bunch of people rocking up and operating competitively for you know, a paid result that they've gotten. But I think, you know, just in terms of where the skill shortage is up to and how much trouble everyone's having hiring, it makes a lot of sense for us to get into that at some point. I mean, right now we're just doing it out of goodwill. So if we have a customer say, hey, like, this person seems to be really productive on our platform, can you facilitate an introduction so we can talk to them about actually recruiting them? We'll do that. We'll obviously ask the tester, but then connect them together. And, you know, the purpose of getting behind that is really to foster goodwill on both sides, because, you know, once a hacker gets hired by one of our clients, they go dark for a month or two while they're playing with new toys, and they come back and do even more with us.
And they've got better skills.
Yeah, and in the meantime, like, they're happy because they've gotten a new job. The customer's happy because they've filled the headcount, and everyone kind of walks away winning. So that's our current approach.
Now, just moving on, you recently hosted what you guys call a bug bash. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so essentially what they are is a live hacking event. So we fly in people, again, that are a good fit to the organization and the technologies that are involved and things like that. And basically over the course of 2 days, do a live hacking event where, you know, the security team, the hackers that we invite, members of our team, and then members of the engineering teams as well, which is kind of a neat feature of it all, get into the same room and hunt bugs, try to break stuff. We did one just recently, I think it was about a month and a half ago now, with Atlassian in Sydney, which was, you know, a proud kind of patriot moment there. But we've done 4 of them this year in total, ranging from platforms like Atlassian to, you know, we did an automotive event where we were pulling out P1s in vehicle platforms. We actually bricked a car at that, which the customer was excited about.
That's good.
The kind of the highlight of that one was, you know, they were so kind of G'd up and had such a good understanding of what they were getting into with getting this.
I got to say, it's like been one of the most pleasant surprises of my career that, you know, Detroit in particular took security stuff so seriously after, you know, Charlie and Chris did their work on Jeep. Like, I did not see that coming, right? And that's that's really cool. Like, who knew that of all of the industries to embrace security as a top concern, it would be automotive? Although I suppose it makes sense because they got a long history in dealing with safety critical systems, because cars are safety critical systems. But look, Casey, we're running out of time, but just before we go, you've got a report coming up that you wanted to use this interview to spruik. Please tell us about the Inside the Mind of a Hacker report.
Oh, well, I couldn't say it with such a great radio voice as that, but yeah, it's a survey that we do on active members of the community every year, talking about what their motivations are, what they've found, what the trends are that they're observing in the industry. And really, you know, the purpose of it is to paint a picture and demystify the personality of these people that are coming in and helping out from the white hat hacker side of things. So that'll come out on Thursday of this week, and obviously it'll stay out in perpetuity. So anyone listening, I encourage you to go and check it out.
Well, Casey Ellis, thank you very much for joining us on this, the last weekly news edition of the Risky Business Podcast for 2018. It's been a real pleasure to chat to you, my friend.
Likewise, happy holidays and happy new year.
That was Casey Ellis there, rounding out the final weekly edition of the show. Thanks for listening to us in 2018, everyone. I really do mean that. I'll be posting a Soapbox edition on Monday, Australia time. But that is it for the weekly show this year. I do hope you've enjoyed it. Until next time, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.